Hello there. Today is Tuesday, January 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. government shutdown is over for now.
We could be back in the same predicament in just a few weeks.
While Vice President Mike Pence visits Israel, the Palestinian leader gets support from the EU. Women are running for office in record numbers in the U.S. Also ahead, new medical technology that seems right out of a Star Trek show. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. Senate Monday voted 81 to 18 to a temporary spending plan to reopen the federal government after a partial three-day shutdown. Senators approved legislation to keep federal agencies open through February 8th. After Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell assured Democratic lawmakers that he would allow a vote in the coming weeks on protecting about 800,000 immigrants brought to the U.S. as children from deportation.
Let's stop victimizing the American people and get back to work on their behalf.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
The Republican majority now has 17 days to prevent the Dreamers from being deported.
VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman describes to International Edition's Sarah Williams how the agreement evolved.
Sarah, this is an agreement that will fund the government through February 8th. The U.S. government has not had a full spending authorization for the full year. Instead, there have been piecemeal appropriations, spending authority passed, lasting several weeks at a time. Democrats went along with Republicans on three stopgap extensions of federal funding, but balked at a fourth late last week after immigration discussions with the White House broke down. And the rub of this was that Democrats wanted some assurance from Republicans that there would be an eventual vote on the legal status of young undocumented immigrants brought to America as children. Trump rescinded their protections late last year, and President Trump has said that he wanted a legislative solution for that. Democrats took the president at his word, but so far Congress has not been able to enact any kind of legislative fix, and Democrats were determined to pressure for that legislative fix in the funding battle. Now, just a little while ago, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell offered an assurance that if the government is allowed to reopen, at least through February 8th, that he intends to bring a bill to the floor on immigration. And that appeared to satisfy enough Democrats to get them to vote to advance this temporary stopgap funding bill that at least keeps the federal government open for three more weeks.
But as you say, it is temporary, and they've had a number of these temporary continuing resolutions in the last few months. In a way, though, is this just, you know, kicking the can down the road until February 8th?
Sarah, in a funding sense, it absolutely is kicking the can down the road. And not only that, but the U.S. government is being funded at 2017 levels. In other words, Congress is supposed to pass funding for the upcoming fiscal year, looking forward as to what America needs and how it should spend its money. A continuing resolution simply extends funding at last year's levels. So this is very much kicking the can down the road, but it is the best that can be done in an era when spending priorities are so contentious. And it's not just on immigration. It's the relative balance of military spending to domestic priorities. There are a whole host of really thorny topics that Congress has yet to iron out.
Thank you so much, Michael, for speaking with me.
Sarah, let me just add that we could be back in the same predicament in just a few weeks, simply because Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell makes a pledge to hold an immigration vote that in no way obligates the House of Representatives to vote on that bill or President Trump to sign any legislation that might come out of all of this. And if there is no ultimate movement on immigration, I very much suspect that Democrats are not going to be all that willing to extend the federal funding yet again. So we could be back in the soup one more time in just a few more weeks.
That's VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman talking to International Edition's Sarah Williams. And turning now to the latest on social media is VOA's Doug Bernard. Hi, Doug.
Well, now that we seem to at least have got something of a deal that at least gets us through the next 3 weeks, of course, we're going to have to see what happens at that point. There's some interesting analysis going on about how social media was being employed. So first off, Politico has an analysis of the two main competing hashtags that were being deployed in this battle, for PR battle, basically. Hashtag Trump shutdown and hashtag Schumer shutdown. And by their analysis, that the hashtag Trump shutdown, which blamed the president more for the shutdown, had about 900,000 retweets, about 400,000 or so unique tweets, and the hashtag Schumer shutdown had considerably less, maybe about $450,000 retweets and about 212,000 unique tweets. But I have to caution here, things aren't always as they seem. And particularly this other study by the German Marshall Foundation, they have a program that tracks Russian botnets. These are these basically computer networks that have been kind of taken over, and they just sort of regurgitate and send out tweets from a whole variety of fake accounts and whatnot. And what they found is that the traffic coming from Russia, particularly the hashtag Schumer shutdown hashtag, increased by 233,000% over this weekend. So it was clear that they were, at least some of the botnets there, were taking sides, as it were, in support of the president and in opposition to Senate Democrats. So I think you have to be very careful, as always, when looking at social media trends and sort of reaching any immediate conclusions, because very often things out there aren't as they seem.
All right, Doug, thank you. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Survivors of a Kabul luxury hotel attack recount the horrors. The U.S. asks Turkey to show restraint in Syria. The Pope apologizes to sex abuse victims but defends the Chilean bishop. And Vermont becomes the 9th U.S. state to legalize marijuana. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence said Monday that the United States would move its embassy to Israel in Israel to Jerusalem by the end of 2019, ahead of schedule. During his two-day visit to Israel, Pence also spoke to Parliament on the final leg of a Middle East tour that included talks with the leaders of Egypt and Jordan.
It is my great honor, on behalf of the President of the United States, to be in Israel's capital, Jerusalem. Following on the president's historic decision, it is a great privilege for me to be here, to have the opportunity to visit with you about issues of common concern, ways that we can strengthen the relationship between the United States of America and Israel, ways that we can confront common challenges. But also I look forward to speaking with you in detail about the opportunity for peace. In making his historic announcement on December the 6th, President Trump did so convinced that by recognizing Israel's capital, Jerusalem, that we would create an opportunity to move on in good faith negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority.
Pence has received a warm welcome in Israel, which has praised the American decision last month to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. But the decision has infuriated the Palestinians and upset America's Arab allies as well. Palestinians are furious at Trump's decision to recognize Israel, Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the most sensitive issue in the conflict. And while Pence was in Israel, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas visited Brussels. At his side, EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini, in what was the bloc's latest challenge to Trump's decision, assured him it supports his ambition to have East Jerusalem as the capital of a future Palestinian state, saying it's the only realistic and viable way to fulfill the legitimate aspirations of both parties.
I want to first of all reassure President Abbas and his delegation of the firm commitment of the European Union to the two-state solution with Jerusalem as shared capital of the two states.
Well, for more on this story, VOA's Victor Beatty asks Middle East expert Michael Fischbach, professor of history at Randolph-Macon College, for his view on the obvious discord between the U.S. and the EU.
That's no surprise, because the Trump administration's recent moves about Jerusalem and other matters have really upended the past quarter century's peace process, generally known as the Oslo process, that the United States itself took the lead in. And it really, on one level, is surprising that it's taken this long. But I think the Europeans, and indeed most of the world community for a long time, have had very different visions about how Israel and the Palestinians should forge a lasting peace, a vision based on internationally accepted norms, based on international law, based on UN resolutions, and that has been quite at odds with United States policy over the decades, and most recently, as expressed by President Trump. So in many ways, this has been a long time in coming, but the Jerusalem question has really ripped it into the open.
What's going to happen now to EU-U.S. relations vis-a-vis the Middle East?
Well, on the one level, it's hard to extricate that particular situation from the sorry state overall of European relations with America. This comes on the heels of displeasure at previous administrations, notably the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq, references to old Europe, differing attitudes about how to deal with Russia, with climate control. So I think this is just one more sharpened edge of a testy relationship. What will be interesting is to see whether the Europeans actually move forward and propose some sort of alternative peace process. It will be interesting to see who, if anyone, wants to step forward. I would remind us all that it is one thing for the Europeans and other powers to criticize American moves and certainly even sympathize with Palestinian aims. It's quite another for them to muster up the diplomatic muscle to actually step in there and try to forge a peace process, especially knowing that Israel would most likely refuse to even participate.
And you've indicated in the past the U.S. in that sense is in a unique position.
Egyptian President Anwar Sadat said as far back as 1970 and 71 that America held, he said, 99% of the cards in the Middle East. And that meant a number of things. But in particular, it meant that with the massive amounts of political and military and diplomatic assistance that the United States provides to Israel, that no party was likely to be able to force concessions from the Israelis, the kind of concessions that would speak to Arab interests other than the United States. So that was ironically saying, we, the Arabs, have to deal with the U.S. even though they are the best friends of our enemy, because only they would be in a position to get the Israelis to move. And that fact has been recognized by the world community, and especially the United States, for decades ever since, that there can be no movement forward without the United States' involvement. But as Vice President Mike Pence made clear in his speech today to the Knesset in Jerusalem, we are on Israel's side. Israel's side, Israel's cause is our cause. And so that's been the conundrum, certainly for the Arabs, but even the Europeans now is, well, how then does one forge Middle East peace, given America's strong backing of one of the two parties?
Michael, I wanted to get one reaction from you to comments made by the Commissioner General of the UN Relief and Works Agency in Gaza, Pierre Krahenbuhl, warning that the U.S. decision to withhold funding to the agency was abrupt and harmful and risked destabilizing the Middle East.
Unfortunately, I think that's true. The Palestinian refugees in general, but notably those of Gaza and the majority of Palestinians in Gaza are refugees, are already living in a dire situation, particularly, as I said, in Gaza. There's a lack of water, there's a lack of electricity, there's a lack of food, there's drastic unemployment, and Israel and Egypt have maintained a total blockade of the area. A humanitarian catastrophe such as food shortages would certainly trigger, is not something in the interest either of stability in the Middle East or of a successful Arab-Israeli peace process. Blaming the victims, the refugees, who since the establishment of UNRWA in 1950 have been dependent upon these kinds of food supports, educational benefits, is not the way to pressure the Palestinian leadership.
Michael Fishbach, professor of history at Randolph-Macon College. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, over the weekend, we saw hundreds of thousands of women marching across the United States and around the world. This clearly turning into a movement. A year ago, we thought maybe there were many women just disappointed that they didn't get to see the first woman elected president. And the big event in Las Vegas this year, dubbed Power to the Polls, has clearly proven to be a call for women to run for office and to vote. Joining us now to discuss is Jennifer Lawless, professor of politics at American University and the author of the book Women, Men, and U.S. Politics, 10 Big Questions. Thanks for being with us. So, interestingly, the march hasn't gotten much attention this time around. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think we're seeing quite a bit of attention, but it's in a somewhat more fragmented way, in that when the march happened last year, the day after the inauguration, it was certainly a direct response to Hillary Clinton's loss, and it served in a lot of ways as a warning to Donald Trump that there are millions of women across the country who are not going to let him get away with the agenda that he proposed. Over the course of the last year, he's doubled down on that agenda. And I think what we've seen is the movement become far more about electoral politics. And it's not now millions of women marching on the same day at the same time, although we did see hundreds of thousands of them. But it's women getting very involved in state legislative contests, in congressional races and swing districts, even in local elections, to make sure that Donald Trump doesn't have Republicans on board to help him enact the agenda that he has. So it went from sort of an abstract concern regarding the Trump and Republican agenda to, I think, a very detailed, clear electoral plan.
Right. And of course, within that time, we've also seen the Me Too movement emerge with all these allegations of sexual assault, sexual harassment coming from every corner of our society, whether it be media, Hollywood, or whatever. And it seems to have empowered women as well to come forward. And that turned into something that I don't think anybody expected.
That's right. Because the behavior that the Me Too movement is condemning is behavior that has existed for a very long time. This didn't start with Donald Trump. But I think what we're seeing is industries apart from politics holding these people accountable and saying to women, stand up, rise up, and we're going to believe you, and we're going to try to change the way the world works. And what that has done, given what Donald Trump himself has said and done about women, is provided, I think, more of an incentive for women to take that movement directly into the political arena and say, look, if Hollywood or if the media are willing to say this is not acceptable behavior. It certainly shouldn't be acceptable on Capitol Hill or in the White House.
Women are running for elected office in record numbers. Is all of the things that we just talked about, is that what's driving it?
That's driving a lot of it. The other thing that's driving it is that women on the Democratic side of the aisle are far more likely to report having been recruited or encouraged to run by elected officials, political activists, the other types of formal electoral gatekeepers. And in the past, what we've seen is a situation where women are less likely than men to be recruited and to be encouraged to run for office. Given this environment, women seem like particularly good candidates, and that gender gap in political recruitment among Democrats is closing. So that's playing a major role in the record number of candidacies. But one thing that is important to keep in mind is that although we have a record number of women running, at the congressional level, for example, we have more than 300 women who have announced, we do have 500,000 elected offices in this country, and we still have a pretty substantial gender gap in political ambition, where women overall are less likely than men to be interested in throwing their hats into the ring. And the size of that gender gap really hasn't changed, even in a post-Trump era. So it's possible to get a record number of women running. It's important to encourage them to do so, but we also have longer-term work ahead of us, which is to make sure that this is something that appears on the radar screens of women, even when you don't have somebody like Donald Trump in the White House.
The president's inaugural anniversary came amidst a government shutdown, but also in the midst of hundreds of thousands of women and men taking to the streets. Do you believe that this is a direct result of the Trump presidency, that Trump has in some way created this?
Yes. And I think it's a result of the Trump administration doing everything that they could for the first 365 days of their administration to send a signal to their base that the promises that were made during the campaign would be fulfilled. And ordinarily, when a president takes office, it's about expanding that base. And although Democrats are still Democrats and Republicans are still Republicans, there's usually more of a concerted effort to find some degree of common ground. We haven't seen that with this administration, and we haven't seen it with this Congress. So this is the first time that we've had unified control, where the Republicans have held both chambers of Congress and the White House, and we've actually shut down the government because they can't figure out how to govern. And so that, coupled with the tone and the tenor of the Trump administration, I think have sustained the concerns that a lot of people had following Trump's inauguration speech. And as a result, it sort of threatened his presidency and the success of the Republicans moving forward, because the concerns that people had on the campaign trail and after the inauguration have been sustained throughout this whole first year in office.
That's Jennifer Lawless, professor of politics at American University here in Washington. VOA's International Edition continues now. While ultrasounds and x-rays help physicians diagnose everything from breast cancer to kidney stones, those scans can't reveal what's inside the masses. And having that immediate knowledge could help millions of patients avoid unneeded stress and surgery. As Erica Celeste reports, groups at both Purdue and Boston universities are developing technology that will be able to provide that internal view.
Dr. Ji-Shin Cheng has devoted his life's work to something that, until now, has sounded a lot like science fiction. He and his team have developed several medical tools that help diagnose patients using sound and light.
We want to make a device like the tricorder in that Star Trek. So the dream, our dream is to make a scientific movie into a real practice.
In the science fiction Star Trek series, the tricorder is waved over a patient to collect information.
Rizzo's alive. Well, your Vulcan metabolism is so low it can hardly be measured.
In conventional medicine, surgeons must either cut out the suspect tissue for analysis or risk exposing already very sick patients to fluorescent dyes and nanoparticles. These so-called labels light up lesions so doctors can study them. Team member Jesse Vang explains their technique, called label-free imaging, eliminates more invasive or toxic procedures by bouncing light off molecules in the tumor.
We do not need labeling. So we can basically look at the vibrations of the molecules, and these vibrations can generate signals in our microscope.
Those vibrations serve as molecular fingerprints unique to each type of molecule. The patterns can be mapped to identify such things as lipids, proteins, and nucleic acid. In essence, the devices give doctors the ability to look at a patient in three instead of two dimensions.
We can see if the patient has a cancer, which usually accumulate a lot of lipids.
The lipo-free imaging devices have shown promise in identifying kidney, liver, and breast cancer. One device, the Margin PAT, funded by the National Institute of Health, will also help breast cancer surgeons remove tumors more efficiently and accurately. In the United States, about a quarter of all breast cancer patients must undergo a second surgery to remove missed malignant cells. The developers expect Margin PAT will dramatically reduce that number. Chang and his partner, Dr. Pu Wang, founded Vibronix to manufacture the device. Wang says it could revolutionize medicine around the world.
In China, the medical practice is not as good as the tier one hospital. So those surgeons can use the setup to perform the similar surgery or provide the care as exactly the same quality as the first tier surgeons.
If all goes as planned, the Margin PAT will be on the market within 3 years, and several more of Chang's label-free imaging devices won't be far behind, making his dream for a real Star Trek tricorder one step closer to reality. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in West Lafayette, Indiana.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us today, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. This is one of a series on the U.S. Constitution and the structure of the U.S. government.
In a bid to protect the rights of citizens, the founders of the United States included in the Constitution, the legal framework of the new government, 10 amendments, 3 to protect individual rights and 7 to ensure justice. They are collectively named the Bill of Rights. The Fifth Amendment defines constitutional limits on the government's prosecution of persons accused of crimes. The amendment's first clause requires that one may not be tried for a serious crime unless he or she is first indicted by a grand jury. The grand jury, an old common law English institution, acted as a sort of filter, protecting the accused from unreasonable or punitive prosecutions by the English monarchy. The framers of the Constitution chose to retain the grand jury system to protect the accused from overzealous prosecution by the central government. The second clause protects the accused from repeated trials for the same offense, so-called double jeopardy. This means that once an individual is found to be innocent of a crime, he or she cannot be harassed through the courts by multiple prosecutions for the same alleged offense. The third clause protects the accused from being forced to testify against him or herself in criminal cases. During trial, a witness may plead the Fifth Amendment, thus declining to answer questions where the answers might incriminate him or her. The fourth, or due process clause, guarantees fair treatment through the judicial system for all persons. It requires the government to respect all rights, guarantees, and protections afforded by the Constitution and all applicable laws before the government can deprive any person of life, liberty, or property. Finally, the Just Compensation Clause declares that although the federal government does have the right to take private property for public use, it must pay the owner of that property fair market value at the time of the taking. The Fifth Amendment prevents excesses of the courts, something that many of the Constitution's framers had witnessed under British rule. It prevents forcing the accused into self-incrimination through intimidation and guarantees fair treatment by the courts. In the words of mid-20th century Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, the Fifth Amendment is an old friend and a good friend, one of the great landmarks in men's struggle to be free of tyranny, to be decent and civilized.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.